So what does wellness mean to you?
Welcome to Wellness Wednesdays. I'm your host, Eric Collard. This week, another special guest. We're broadcasting live from the Bridgehead headquarters. We're in the training center with Ian Clark, the director of coffee from Bridgehead. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Actually, I was lucky enough to take one of the courses where you taught a sliver of what you know about coffee. And that got me kind of thinking, like, I mean, especially I'm not a coffee connoisseur, but a coffee enthusiast. And I love coffee. I drink coffee every day. I don't think a day is a day without coffee. Mm-hmm. I've read a little bit on coffee. I've experienced a bunch of different things. I've tried the French press, tried the drip, tried the what's the plastic one that you guys carry?
Oh, AeroPress.
Yeah, AeroPress.
Yeah.
Good. I use that for the road. And now I have a new espresso machine. Mm-hmm. Although you might not approve because it's an automatic one.
Well, in my earlier days, I would not have maybe approved of that. But I'm older and a little bit more easygoing now. But there's a trade-off. There's always a trade-off between convenience and quality.
Yeah.
And with espresso in particular, as you discovered in that class that we did, if you completely throw convenience out the window, you can make world-class espresso even with relatively inexpensive equipment at home. Yeah. But it's extremely messy. It's really expensive. And you either love that because it becomes kind of an obsession and a hobby, and that's how I first got into coffee. Actually, was I was thrown into a situation where I was asked to make espresso for people when I was 17 years old, I think, maybe 18, I found it a fascinating challenge. You have this equipment where there's all this stuff going on inside. You can't really see what's going on, but it's a big box. And out the one end, you just get this little stream of liquid coming out. And depending on what you do, managing various elements of preparation, that little liquid will look and taste totally different. And I found them kind of the mystery and challenge of that pretty cool. And at the time, in the early 2000s, there were many other similarly interested people around the world kind of fascinated by how do you make this beverage that usually tastes absolutely disgusting, espresso, and how do you turn it through a little bit of knowledge and craft
science
and experimentation, how do you make this thing that is usually really quite vile and make it taste absolutely delicious? That was a cool challenge, and so that's kind of what got me into coffee at first. Yeah.
And you've been coffee ever since, basically?
Yeah.
Can you take us through quickly of your career? Now you're you're almost a walking coffee encyclopedia. I've followed you on Twitter, and you go all over the world and try coffees. For people that like coffee, you have almost a perfect job, but it just didn't happen.
No, it was
a lot of work.
Yeah, there are many stages to my career. So I've been working in coffee for like 15 years now, and it's basically been the only thing I've ever done for work, apart from like a brief stint right before getting into coffee, where I my first job was at Beaver Tails here,
okay,
for example. So no coffee there.
Do they have good coffee now?
At Beaver Tails? Yeah, I haven't tried that.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't even know if they do coffee, but no comment.
Yeah.
If I had, but So it's been kind of something that I've worked in my entire life. And at first, it was this kind of barista obsession. So huge focus on espresso. And I found that really fascinating. It was really fun to communicate with other people around the world and theorize on message boards and all this kind of thing.
Nerd out.
Yeah, totally. Every day. I was in my late teens, still in school. And I'd go to work and I kind of play around with the equipment and, sort of happily make people better coffee all day. And then go home and spend like an hour or two just like checking out all the forums, seeing what people were saying, and then couldn't wait to go to work the next day. It was really cool. So that really got me interested in it. And so the first number of years of my career were really focused on being a barista, like espresso making, with Bridgehead. That began in 2008. So I finished university, and then I...
Fairly short. What did you take in university?
I took like law and economics,
okay.
So nothing to do with. I mean, in a very limited way related to coffee. There was a useful education, but not specifically. But when I graduated, I felt that I knew more about coffee and had more of an expertise in coffee than in any other of those subjects. So I kind of went with it. So 2008, I started in more of a management role at Bridgehead, being responsible for how we prepare the coffee. So we weren't doing anything on really on the supply chain at the time in terms of sourcing and roasting. So it took over how we brew and train baristas, and had a responsibility for implementing what we call semi-automatic espresso. So that's an espresso machine where you have it basically just on and off. You don't have programs for how much volume over time comes out or anything. So simple on and off espresso machines like we use now, with separate grinders, which at the time and arguably still today is sort of the best way to make great espresso. There is more technology nowadays that allows you to program the weight of espresso that comes out and the volume. But
you
anyway.
Can, and speaking of geeking out, you can totally geek out on espresso. And most people, yeah. And then I've had this conversation with some friends, most people think coffee is coffee. They're like, no, it's like, yeah. Tastes the same. Like Tim Hortons is the same as Starbucks, is the same as McDonald's, mm-hmm. Same as Bridgehead.
Yeah.
And as you know, as a coffee connoisseur, and I know that, and I'm not even up there, but it's like, no way. Like, yeah. It's like wine, it's like cigars, it's like every good thing.
Yeah. Anything that has any kind of variation in quality, yeah. You've got the low end, and you got
Tim Hortons.
you got way better stuff out there too. Yeah, and there's a huge range. We don't even see in North America. We don't even see the worst of it. The vast majority of coffee that comes into North America is exquisite compared to what is consumed in producing countries, where you've got various tiers of second grade, third grade, fourth grade coffee that don't even get exported. And the majority that does get exported is stuff that we don't even want to touch, because it's still really not, it really doesn't taste good at all. But yeah, there's huge ranges. So espresso was a big focus at the time. Then I had great opportunities to get involved in national and international competitions. I got kind of focused on judging. So I was involved with the World Barista Championship for a while, which was a really awesome experience to get to learn from similar people around the world, Europeans, Australians, Americans, primarily. Got to travel a lot for world championships, doing national championships in Latin America and so on. So
is this latte art, or is it actual just the espresso?
Is the barista competition. So okay. there is now a latte art championship, a world latte art championship. But the first competition was a barista competition, where you make four judges, each an espresso, a cappuccino, and a signature drink of your own design that needs to be coffee focused. And needs to be very intelligent, and a very intelligent and thematic marriage of the coffee and other ingredients. And you have 15 minutes to do that. And then my involvement was more on the technical side. So while the competitor is doing that, they used to have two technical judges. It's evolved a bit since then, but there were two technical judges that would basically follow their every movement and like track every single fraction of a gram of waste that they made and every smudge they made on the machine. And at the World Championship, you had to be like the most technically perfect barista in the world, obviously. So I got really involved in that for a while. Had a lot of opportunities to learn from that, which was cool. And then the next major stage for my sort of journey in coffee came when we started vertically integrating into sourcing and roasting coffee. So that was a transition around 2011, 2012, where we basically decided that there was a really good business case for doing that ourselves in terms of controlling the quality and being able to do it in-house. There's efficiencies in doing that. So that meant basically building a whole new green coffee supply chain for our company in terms of partnerships with importers and partnerships with producer cooperatives, learning all about green coffee contracts and the whole green coffee buying trade, becoming a cupper, so learning how to cup coffee, which is something that I had some experience with starting in about 2008, but really doing it full on, like really doing serious evaluations of coffee and learning about how an evaluation of a green coffee, for example, on pre-shipment or when you're with a producer during harvest, how that relates to what that coffee is going to taste like and be useful for 6 months later, understanding the risks of time and environment and so on coffee. So that was really cool.
Just so you know, I interrupt a lot, but it's funny that you mention all this stuff, but most people, all they do is go to the store and buy already ground coffee. Mm-hmm. And like the shitty Maxwell House and then put it in their coffee maker and then make it, and they're like, this is good.
Yeah.
And like, what, and then that's the only problem now is like, I know too much. I read a great book called God in a Cup.
Yeah.
I've been lucky. I've tasted coffee from all over the world. I went to Nicaragua when I was down there doing a volunteer project and got to try a couple different coffees down there. And well, I'm sure you've been down there, and it's, the coffee's pretty good. I mean, obviously the good stuff is pretty good. Now I can't go back and drink crappy stuff. And
That's the typical case for me too. Like when I was in university, I was fueled on Tim Hortons. You know, there are many experiences I recall in the past where I thought something was really good, and I look back at it now and I was like, what was I thinking? But we all follow that journey where
ignorance is bliss, right?
Yeah, and you still like you there is subjectivity to what you enjoy.
Yeah.
Like there are many people in the world that legitimately enjoy like really cheap supermarket brand coffee. They have a good experience drinking it, but.
But, so, okay, I'll throw a little wrench and a monkey wrench in that.
Sure.
If you expose them to some real good stuff, don't you think they would enjoy that more?
Some would and some wouldn't.
You think people that, even if you educate them and increase their palates and they would like the shitty Tim Hortons Double Double?
I think a lot of, if I made good judgments about what to give them, to bring them along on that journey, if you will. So if we assume that there's this kind of like linear path towards better coffee, you know, you and I have been on that journey where that's true. If I gave them something that was an appropriate next step on that stage, so it was similar in terms of having coffee-like aromas, so like coffee-like aromas were like caramelly, toasty, nutty, like things that taste like coffee as opposed to flowers and fruit and all the stuff that you can get in coffee that us coffee people obsess about. If you give them something that's approachable, it's like it's proximal to their understanding of coffee, but it's better. The texture is better. It's less bitter. It's sweeter. It is just overall more intense and beautiful. Then, most people will prefer that. And that's kind of how people go on their journey, is they have to go from that, like, their, like, supermarket free ground year old, like, really boring coffee, like, just, like, tastes kind of like probably tastes like wheat and like stale toast in the best case scenario.
Yeah.
You move them to something that tastes more like legitimately tastes like freshly, you know, toasted nuts and like nice caramels and vanilla or something like that. They're going to prefer that. Yeah. And they're going to see that you only have to pay maybe 20 cents more for a cup. And they're going to go, okay, I'm on board for this. And then slowly those people go, okay, they get used to that. And then you go, okay, how about, you know, you give them something like you give them a high altitude wet processed Guatemalan coffee that's really immaculately processed from a producer that's growing really healthy trees, and it's got these cool floral notes suddenly. So it smells like flowers, and there's a little bit of like maybe strawberry flavor in there. And there's acidity to it too, which is something that people don't experience in lower end coffee. You get acidity from higher altitude coffees that are well roasted and that are well prepared. And if they're well roasted, if they're fresh green coffee, well roasted and well brewed, and all three of those have to happen, and they have to be really high quality coffees, that acidity can balance with sweetness and it can taste delicious. So then those people go, ooh, I'm kind of on board with this. This is even better than what I just had. And so people go on this journey, and then eventually they look for the next thing. And usually that's going to be like some crazy, super flowery Ethiopian coffee or Kenyan coffee. And people just have this journey.
It's okay. So what makes, and you touched upon it a little bit, but what makes a good cup of coffee?
Yeah, that's, so that entirely depends on who's drinking it.
Okay.
I guess, are you saying like what are the factors that go into a good cup of coffee?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's I know that everyone's got different taste buds, but I mean, when you judge a competition or when you judge coffee or what makes good coffee versus bad coffee?
So from our view, which is pretty calibrated with like the specialty coffee industry, we're looking for, there are two fields to focus on there. One of them is what I'll call like cleanliness and like the sort of like general health of that coffee. And then the next one is how extraordinary is it? So it sort of has to, you want it to pass a certain basic threshold of like, it doesn't suck. Like it tastes nice. And so that's on our, we have a scoring scale internationally. And the effective score for good coffees is 80 to 90 points. And for us, we're usually looking for a minimum of 84 points. This is separate from, like, if people are familiar with the wine scale, it's not the same. Yeah. An 84-point coffee would probably be like a, probably like an 89-point wine kind of thing. Like, you know, you go to the LCBO, you go to the wine store, and you see, like, usually the lowest score they'll ever put up is like 89 or something.
Yeah.
So anyway, that wine or that coffee, it's going to have, it's only going to have pleasant characteristics. There's nothing in it that you don't like. So in coffee, things you don't like could be very, very common would be resulting from underripe coffee, low altitude coffee, or poorly picked coffee where unripe cherries are mixed with ripe cherries, or nutrition starved plants. These are all going to lead to like cereally and woody and wheaty flavors, or like raw nuts, these kinds of things.
What does altitude have to do with it?
Altitude, to my knowledge, it's mostly a correlation to temperature. So as you get higher up in the mountains in the tropics, you get very stable temperatures, so like 20, 25 degrees year round. It doesn't really get below 15, doesn't really get above like 28. Coffee is a very fragile plant. It hates extremes in temperature. It depends on really particular rainfall patterns to thrive and also to yield enough, well, to yield optimally. So if you have colder temperatures, it'll take longer for the fruit that bears the seed to ripen, and you get a more nutrient-dense seed. So if it's higher altitude, lower temperature, you might have 2 months longer on the maturation time on the seed. You get more nutrients, which means more sugars, more amino acids, and we turn those into flavor when we roast coffee. So if you don't have those because it's underripe, or there aren't enough nutrients in the soil, or the plant's not healthy enough to take in those nutrients, or the temperature is too high and it ripens really quickly, then you don't get the nutrient density that you need to create flavor, and you get these like boring, woody, cereally flavors. So those coffees are like, say that coffee might be like 83 points, the one I just described. Below that, it's going to have some really undesirable characteristics. So you can get characteristics like a kind of like off rubbery flavors or weird fermentation flavors.
So what happens to that coffee?
They're pretty common. Like those are out there in the market, and we just, okay, you know, we don't buy them.
Yeah.
But they're very, very common. It's really hard to produce coffees that are this 84 plus, really ripe, really clean, no problems with harvesting, fermentation, and that kind of thing. So those are normal coffees, and they tend to get roasted a lot darker to cover up those flavors.
Oh, because that's why. Okay.
Yeah, like that tends to be what happens with them. They don't taste very good if you roast them later. So above that, 84 is that point where it's like, it tastes really good, but it's kind of boring. But it tastes nice. And that's actually really hard to do. Like those coffees are rare. We actually have to work pretty hard just to get those. And then you have sort of every point above that up towards 90 is one marginal step tastier. So 85 is like kind of simple. It represents the origin well. So it tastes like a Honduran coffee from Lake Yehoa or Marcala, or it tastes like a Guatemalan coffee from Huehuetenango. But it's not extraordinary, but it's tasty. Yeah. 86, ooh, this is nice coffee. Like, this is really good. 87, that's amazing. It's phenomenal. 88, 89, 90, these are just marginal steps more mind-blowing until you get to 90 where you're just doing a dance because it's so delicious.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how the scale works. And those, so what factors lead to that? The same kind of thing. Health of the plant, nutritional availability, temperature, exposure to sunlight, proper pruning of the trees, proper pruning of shade plants, the right variety of the tree in the right soil. There's tons of agricultural variables. The control over ripeness is huge. So picking the coffee just at the right degree of ripeness. The control over...
How do you know when something's ripe?
They do it with color, usually. Okay. So they look at the color of the coffee. And that, I mean, you could probably develop more sophisticated measures, like, you know, go around with a Brix meter and measure the sugar of the fruit or something like that, but coffee producers don't have those resources. And also, I don't know a lot about, like, wine growing as a
It's funny, analogy, it's funny you mentioned that, because we just had a winemaker on recently, and it's a lot of stuff you're talking about. It's just, yeah, exact same thing. He talks about, you know, temperature and variation and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's very similar, and it'd be interesting to know more about that. But, like, I don't know how uniformly grapes ripen on a vine. Coffee cherries do not ripen uniformly. They'll ripen a bit more uniformly if you have extremely stable rainfall kind of patterns throughout the year, because rainfall triggers flowering, which then yields fruit. So like if you have like no rain for 3 months and then a ton of rain, you're going to get a ton of flowering. But if you have like sporadic rain after the dry season, you'll have very uneven ripening. And that's more typically the case. And so farmers, they're not only looking for the like perfect degree of ripeness, but they're selectively picking from each tree. And that's really expensive to do because you got to do multiple passes around a farm. So there has to be a financial incentive in place to actually do that. That's kind of a whole other conversation in terms of like, normally there is no financial reward for producing quality coffee because by and large, the industry isn't really looking for that 86 point delicious coffee. Yeah. So that like ripe cherry control, picking just the perfectly ripe cherries is not a normal practice unless that producer knows that there's a buyer that is interested in that. Or they work for their, like the farmer is part of some association or organization that is pushing to get into that market.
Yeah, it's funny. Every industry is supply and demand, supply and demand. Yeah.
Yep.
You just mentioned some of the stuff. So can you tell us, can you educate folks at home? I got a little bit through that God in a Cup book, but the waves of coffee.
Yeah.
And where we're at and how it's evolved over the last 20 years. I mean,
yeah.
Probably a little bit longer, but 20 years has been a lot of changes.
Yeah, a lot of change. Yeah. And like I've been sort of part of it for 15 and I learned a little bit about how it used to be, you know, from other people that are more senior, older in the business. And it's got a little bit cloudy in more recent years because the waves, the concept of the waves came about in like the mid late 2000s when this sort of this branch of specialty coffee was starting to mature and it was starting to come out of hobbyists kind of like myself and like hobbyist baristas with a kind of sort of speckling of companies around the world actually practicing this type of coffee to becoming a bit more ubiquitous, where like every city had a company or a couple of companies practicing it. So the idea was that there was this sort of, I guess the first wave of coffee was just like very traditional coffee, drinking it in your home, you know, nothing social really about it. It was just like people drank coffee and they did it at home and you maybe got it at a diner and that kind of thing.
And class, but quality wasn't a huge deal.
No, and quality was, no. I mean, there in terms of the industry organization, there were very relatively fewer standards for quality. There would have been some, but they would have been basic. So like very basic physical grading of coffee for like really bad defects, like mold and stuff to not make it through. And, you know, at the time, people would have had certain standards, but certainly the level of detail that we go into right now for quality did not exist. But the waves are more a bit more a reference to how people experience consumption as opposed to how the industry treats it. Yeah. And consumption was experienced where coffee was kind of a generic commodity. I guess that's maybe the best way to describe first wave is coffee is a generic commodity and you're drinking it in typically not in a social environment. So you're drinking it at home where you're making it at home, maybe at work, but you don't have a coffee house. The second wave of coffee is sort of was defined as this transition to drinking coffee in cafes. Perhaps more normal in the European market. In North America, that became a thing really with Starbucks, more or less, and other kind of, you know, independent coffee houses that would have started in the 70s and 80s. So the second wave usually is discussed sort of 70s, 80s, 90s, where people started to drink coffee socially. And it still wasn't defined by the quality of the coffee. The coffee was a vehicle to social activity, to gathering together. But again, coffee was still a commodity. That hadn't changed. You did have some companies that were trying to differentiate theirs. Usually darker roasting became a thing. So our coffee is stronger and more powerful because we're darker roasting it. But really, it was about the social environment. And then the third wave was used to describe this shift to, it's a bit debatable how people have interpreted it, but either a focus on the coffee itself, like let's not treat it like a commodity, but we're going to decommodify it, and we're going to treat it like a really artisanal product that's unique to the farm, not just the country, not just the region, but to the farm it came from, the farmer that grew it, the variety of it, the processing method, all these things. Other people look at third wave and think of it's all about the barista, it's the skill of the barista that goes into making that coffee, or the skill of the roaster. So there's different interpretations of it based on people's personal interest. But the obsession, third wave is sort of the obsession over like the quality, the uniqueness, the crafts, details, yeah. the details. Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, since that was about 10 years ago. So since then, I think people are constantly looking for where the industry is going to go next. So what's the next focus? You know, we've seen from in the 2000s a huge focus on espresso. That's what everyone was interested in. To in the late 2000s till today, a huge focus on filter coffee. So just straight like simple pour over methods. So like AeroPress, you're mentioning, yeah. Kalita V60, that kind of thing. Because that really highlights in a bit more of a transparent way the unique qualities of every green coffee. So again, it's this obsession with like the agricultural side and agricultural variables and transparency to the source, that kind of thing.
And so you've been lucky enough to taste coffee all over the world. What's your favorite coffee these days? What region, what roast? Are you a dark guy?
So I'm like, I mean, sort of the lighter roast definitely is something that myself and like virtually all sort of contemporary coffee professionals, that's what they're after, because that's what reveals the kind of greatness of any individual green coffee. So with lighter roasted coffee, you're going to get unique sweetness, unique acidity. You don't really get much bitterness, and you can get really, really interesting, beautiful textures, really interesting, beautiful flavors. So that's kind of what everyone's focused on. And that is also something that defines the third wave of coffee. It's really all about lighter roasted coffee. But you don't want to roast it too light. If you roast your coffee too light, which can be a bit of a mistake that's made quite often now, you get coffee that's just like sour and toasty and nutty and not very good. So like I would describe myself as something that likes like lighter roasted coffee, but with the caveat that, you know, I don't really like the word light because people think of like watery and, yeah. and not good. And so, you know, we usually use the word medium just to not prejudice the coffee. Because it describes it as not being like there's the dichotomy of medium and dark, but we don't want to say light because it prejudices that coffee. And it's so the other way to talk about it is it's I think balanced coffee is kind of a word people would use where it's sweet and there's acidity and the flavors are clean and pure and delicious. That's what I like. And then in terms of my favorite coffee. Is really hard to say.
Is there a region that you like right now? Because like, I mean, I know it's like it's...
It's like so based on time of year because of harvest cycles. Yeah. And I have these like emotional connections to countries that cloud my interests. So like I spend a lot of time in Honduras and some of my favorite people in coffee are in Honduras. So, like I love Honduran coffees. They're a little more simple than coffees from Guatemala, Ethiopia, Kenya, Colombia, and so on. But I love those coffees because I know the story behind them. And I think that's a powerful thing for a lot of our customers, too. Guatemala is an amazing country in terms of the culture there, the diversity in the landscape, the beauty of the landscape. And then the coffees are very diverse, and they can be just amazingly beautiful, like floral, strawberry, peach, blueberry-type flavors. Really cool. I don't think I have a favorite coffee, but I really like many things about different countries' coffees, for sure.
Yeah. So that was a very political answer. We should get into politics. So take us through from beginning to end. How long does it take from coffee to, like, from a coffee plant to roasting to getting into your cup? Like, what's the typical? And I know there's a lot of range, but
So there's kind of an annual cycle that we're always repeating. So like the life cycle of a cup of coffee begins with rainfall after a dry season in a coffee producing area. So rainfall triggers flowering. Those flowers within, I'm not really sure exactly how long, but I think it's like a week or two, will yield kind of new buds, little, you know, tiny little green buds that will grow over a period of about 7 to 9 months, depending on like the temperature and the altitude. Yeah. Just call it 9 months as a model, to a perfectly ripe cherry with two seeds in it. And if you get, I'm not sure how many it would be, but say you get like 20 of those, that's going to be, you know, one cup of coffee. So the farmer will pick those the same day. They're going to pulp the fruit away if it's a wet process coffee, which most are. and then ferment that coffee, usually in like a bucket, or if they're bigger, in a big concrete tank for 24 hours usually. And then that coffee is going to dry for, could be 3 or 4 days, it could be 3 weeks, depends on where they are. And then that coffee will probably sit in a warehouse, could be for 2 or 3 months, in a, what's called a reposo period, a resting period. And that's the time where it's being marketed. So that's the time where the exporter, could be a cooperative, could be a miller, who has control of that coffee at that point, is looking for someone to buy it. So usually we'll go and visit producers, typically twice a year. So like we do a lot of work every March with almost every producer we work with in Central America. So right after harvest, we're there in that reposo period, tasting coffee, making all of our selections. So if we use Honduras as an example, the harvest there will end, kind of depends on the year, but just call it sort of end of February, early March. We'll go down mid-March, late March, taste everything. Once we line up contracts, we line up the exact coffees that we want to be putting in our container, that coffee might ship in April or May and arrive here like June, July. So we're now, that's like 4 months or something after the harvest, that coffee's harvested. And then from there, we can have it here in a couple of days after it arrives. And then we might roast it the same day. In fact, that's what we're planning on doing in a couple days with our first squats that are going to come in from this year's harvest. And then once it's roasted, you want to consume it within about 3 days to 2 weeks. So you don't really want to be consuming it before 3 or 4 days. There's way too much carbon dioxide in the coffee. Okay. After about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you start to get oxidation. So the coffee, the flavors in the coffee get oxidized and they turn kind of boring and kind of like bready or toasty or nutty. And so that there's that window. That's kind of the timeline. Yeah.
Right. So it doesn't happen overnight.
No, there's a long process. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, my brain is usually kind of focused on that, like that annual cycle with the harvests, and
you're already planning for next year.
Yeah. Like we've got contracts of coffee booked through booked through next summer already. So, so a year, usually a year, even more than that ahead, like we've contracted for coffee that's still ripening on trees. Okay. That we'll be drinking next year. So we're thinking about that already, yeah.
Why do you think people love coffee so much?
It's such a different experience for so many different people.
But I think most adults, and I'll be honest with you, when people don't drink coffee, I think there's something wrong with them.
Yeah.
But I think most, and I don't know the stats on this, but most adults drink coffee.
I think so. Yeah. 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 I mean, certainly most that I see.
Yeah. You're biased. You work in a coffee shop.
Yeah.
I love coffee.
Yeah.
Why, like you've been around coffee for 15 plus years.
Yeah.
Why do you think people love coffee so much?
Well, you can't ignore the kind of psychoactive properties of it, right? Like on a fundamental level,
caffeine is
like there is at least some form of addiction kind of going on there. Yeah. Anyone who's tried to quit coffee for a few days knows that. There's a reward process going on in your brain, right? Like you desire that caffeine, you consume it, it makes you feel really good, and it's awesome to have that experience every day, and it, you know, gets you out of bed looking forward to an experience. And the great thing about coffee is it's not only that like immediate psychoactive response, and for a lot of people also it's also the sugar that they put in their coffee, and it's also the fat they put in their coffee too, right? It's a triple threat. Yeah. For a lot of people, coffee is like a drip coffee with cream and sugar. So you got the triple threat of sugar, fat, and caffeine hitting your brain all at the same time. Yeah. So you can't ignore that kind of psychoactive effect, but you also have a sensory side to it. You got a social side to it, and those make it all the more compelling. If it didn't have those, it wouldn't be nearly as broadly consumed. But
isn't it one of the most traded commodities in the world?
Yeah. So there's this whole, like, you always see anytime anyone does an article about coffee, they always start off of books about coffee. I always start off with this kind of myth that the coffee is like the second most valuable commodity in the world next to oil. And I'm pretty sure, I may be wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure the actual stat was that coffee is the most valuable export commodity for
third world countries.
I'm not sure if it was that. It's like the most valuable export commodity for, maybe it was developing countries, behind oil in the world, something like that. Yeah. It's like not quite as grand as this sort of thing that usually goes around, where it's that the second most traded commodity in the world next to oil. But that's not, so that's a little bit of a check on that one, as I understand, myth about coffee. But that said, coffee is a massively important global commodity.
And it's been around for a few years. Like, it's not like it, I mean, yes, they only got, like, the waves have only kind of started recently, but
yeah,
it's been around for 20,000 years or whatever. Like, I mean,
I don't know the entire history of it in Ethiopia, but it started in Ethiopia, southwestern Ethiopia, where, as I understand, it was largely consumed as like a tea leaf extraction. So they would like basically boil the leaves, you'd get some caffeine from that, some stimulation from that. And that's kind of how it was consumed traditionally. I think the roasting came in something like 1,000 years ago.
Okay.
I might be slightly wrong on the date. And then it spread throughout the kind of Arabian Peninsula, more like, I think it was like 14th century around there. And then really started to get noticed by Europeans and European trading companies in, I believe, the 16th century, thereabouts, you know, give or take 100 years or so. And they moved it, they started to move it around between India and their colonies in like Indonesia and so on. So the trading companies from like the Dutch and the British, for example, became heavily involved in sort of moving it around like the Arabian world and South Asia and so on. And eventually they brought it back to Europe. And then from there it spread throughout Europe into coffee houses all over. And then it didn't really come to the Americas as an important agricultural product until, in many cases, like early to mid 19th century. So, like, for example, the first coffee trees planted in Honduras, for instance, were like something like 1820. It was early 19th century, and they were planted not as a cash crop, but as an important medicinal crop for personal use of the landowners.
Okay. Coffee enemas.
They may have been practicing those, but I haven't read the history of coffee enemas. But it was actually considered a medicinal crop at the time. Okay. So
it is coffee is my medicine.
Yeah. Well, and there is a very long history there's a very large body of research that shows that it's very good for you. It really is good for one's longevity, for sure, in terms of the health of one's mind and one's body. So
love it.
Mm-hmm.
We could probably geek out all day about coffee. It's something I enjoy talking about, and obviously it's something you know a lot about. But I want to be mindful of your time. So before I let you go, a couple of questions. One is a question I ask all my guests. And what does wellness mean to you?
You can
throw coffee in there, too.
Yeah. I mean, I think...
But I'm more looking on the global scale.
Yeah, and like a more holistic scale. Wellness, to me, means, broadly speaking, being sort of content, challenged, engaged, sound of mind, sound of body, optimized, and living a life full of meaning. I don't know. Those are words that come to mind. I mean, there's so many... It's a very all-encompassing thing, I think, right?
Yeah.
But I'm personally always trying to find ways to improve my wellness in different ways. If it's through, like, the meaning in my life that comes from, for example, like, my marriage, from my job, from pursuit of fitness, for example, pursuit of, better nutrition, optimizing oneself. Like, those things add meaning. Moral wellness. Staying true to oneself and one's values, and I don't know, there are many aspects of it. I couldn't quite narrow it down to one. Yeah.
No, and that's why I love it. And I've asked this question. Everyone comes at it differently, so it's just part of the fun.
Yeah,
it's part of the fun of this podcast.
Yeah.
If people want to know more about you and the company, where are the best ways to on the socials? Because I know you're fairly active on Twitter and...
Usually I'll do a lot of Instagram stuff when I'm traveling. I'm trying to do some more YouTube work, actually. So I have like hours of video from our buying this spring that I'm just... those coffees are just about to... they just landed. Yeah. We're just about to start selling them. So trying to do some more stuff on YouTube, which should really hope... My goal is to very effectively represent... kind of the farmer side of things and what we do when we're working with them. But yeah, sort of the Britched Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, there's stuff on there.
Okay.
And then YouTube.
Yeah, as well. I'll link all these in the show notes.
Cool.
Thank you so much for your time. And again, we'll probably have to do a part two and geek out some more about the specifics on growing and roasting and all that stuff. So
it keeps on going and going. Yeah, so I'd be happy to do some more. Yeah.
Well, thanks again. You've been listening to Wellness Wednesdays. I'm your host, Eric Collard. Until next week, be well.